Majority of citizens support term limits and distrust Congress. Polling shows Congress with lower approval ratings than hemorrhoids, traffic jams, and root canals. Politicians are narrowly more popular than head lice, but the lice are demanding a recount. Despite all this, though, term limits have remained elusive. And perhaps my guest today, Scott Murphy, author of The Term Limit Revolution, can shed some light on this conundrum. Scott Murphy, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. So tell me more about this idea that you and so many Americans support, this idea of term limits. What is it and why do you want it?
Term limits basically limits the length of time that a politician can serve in an office. The reason we want it is because it's really the only way to truly root out the corruption that we have in our political system today. Mm-hmm. No bank teller embezzles funds their first day on the job. It's the person that's been there for 20 years that figures out how to game the system, and then they game it from there. They game it for their own benefit. One of the things that you, when you stop to think about it, common sense will tell you, the number one priority of a politician is getting reelected. That's their number one priority, because if they don't get reelected, then they're out of a job. So the number one thing they have to do is get reelected. So that means they got to start campaigning as soon as the previous campaign's over. Every 2 years, we reelect people in the House of Representatives. So these folks are out there campaigning, raising money, even in years when they don't have an opponent. They're out there raising money, campaigning, cozying up to lobbyists, trading favors, doing things that will ensure that in case they do have an opponent, that they're going to be able to beat them. They want to make sure that they stay in office. Now, one of the things that we see with professional politicians is the longer they're in office, the more bulletproof they are. Like I said, they'll raise money even in a year when they don't have an opponent. So if you decide that you want to go and run against somebody, you're going to run for Congress. So you have this idea, I'm going to run for Congress because I'm not happy with what's going on there. So you start out, and how much money do you have in your campaign account right now? You've got none.
Okay.
So you have zero. Your opponent, who's been in for 20 years, may have $4 or $5 million in their account. How many people do you have ready to go who've worked for you on campaigns before? You have zero. They have a ground game already established. They have connections to lobbyists who want to make sure that they stay in office because they vote the way that lobbyist wants them to vote. So they've got access to money. They've got access to people. They've already got signs bought. They've already got sign locations secured. They have everything that they need, and you're starting out at zero.
A more than unfair advantage.
Very, very unfair. So it would be kind of like a 100-yard dash. I'm 63 years old, but I can beat Usain Bolt in a 100-yard dash if I'm given the advantages that the incumbent is given over the challenger. Mm-hmm. So for having $5 million in the bank, you go 30 yards up. For having an office there, you can go another 5 yards. For having people already established, you can go another 5 yards. You just keep going. The franking privileges, have you ever heard of the franking privileges?
I have not.
Okay, the franking privileges are the people that are in Congress can send mail home to their constituents. Now, they can't say, vote for me, but what they can say is, look at the great things that I've done. So they take taxpayer dollars and they send out campaign literature, which is not really campaign literature because it doesn't say vote for me, but it is campaign literature because it's getting their picture out, their name out, and the things that they've done out, and they're doing it on the taxpayer dime. You as the challenger, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. So eventually, they get a 95-yard head start and a 100-yard dash. And again, I can beat Usain Bolt if you give me a 95-yard head start. I'm not very fast, never was, But I don't need to be fast. I don't need to be good. All I need to be is the incumbent. And if I'm the incumbent, I'm going to win. Now, from time to time, you'll see a challenger come in and win. When that happens, it's generally during some period of a uprising, a revolt. People are angry. The incumbent didn't take the challenger seriously. And one of the best examples of that is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was a bartender. She decided to run for Congress. The person that was she was running against, the incumbent, didn't take her seriously. She went out and did a good job. She campaigned hard. She had a lot of personable skills. She was able to go out and connect with people, and she beat this person. So now the people who are against term limits say, well, look at her. Look at her. She won. But in reality, the odds of beating an incumbent, or the odds of an incumbent losing, I'll put it that way, the odds of incumbent losing are the incumbent has better odds than what a number one seed has against a 16 seed in the NCAA tournament. Mm-hmm. It's easier for a 16 seed to beat a number one, or statistically it happens more often than a than an incumbent loses.
Well, in Congress, when someone runs for re-election, they get it more than 90% of the time.
Oh,
correct?
No, much higher than that.
More than 90%?
Much more, yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. In the year that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won, in the primary, there was, I think there were four people that were defeated in the primary. There was 33 senators running, 435 representatives running, and four of them lost in the primary. Now, one of the things that people don't understand about the primary and the difference between a primary and a general is that if you are in a highly partisan district, then you're not going to be beaten in a general election. That's just not going to happen. And if you are a popular person who toes the party line, who does what the party tells you to, you just shut up and vote the way they want you to, then they want you back in. And they're going to see to it that you are reelected. They're going to make sure that in a primary that you're the guy that they're going to back. And that makes it even more difficult for that challenger to come in. Not only do they have to work against the incumbent and the 95-yard head start that they have to work against the party too. In 2000, there was a challenger to I believe it was Bobby Rush in Chicago, a congressman on the south side of Chicago. He had a challenger. And sometimes you'll get these challengers that'll come in that they're just a goof, that they go out and decide to run for Congress, whether they believe they have a chance or not. Everybody understands they don't have a chance. They don't have any money. They're not going to try and get any money. They're just kind of having fun running for Congress. And sometimes that happens. Well, Bobby Rush beat this guy that challenged him, doubled him up, beat him 66 to 33%, something like that. Which again, if the guy's just a goof who's just in it for fun, that's one thing. That was in 2000. And in 2008, the guy that Bobby Rush just beat the crap out of in a heavy, heavy, heavy Democrat primary that was predominantly African American on the south side of Chicago. In 2008, that guy that he just destroyed was sworn in as president of the United States. Hmm. So that was Barack Obama. So Barack Obama could not beat an entrenched incumbent in a Democratic primary on the south side of Chicago. And no matter what you think about Barack Obama as his policies, he was a slick politician. He was a good speaker. He presented well. He could connect with people. He could make people believe in him. He was a great campaigner. Mm-hmm. And he just got destroyed because of the incumbent advantage.
Right. Now, let's back up a second. When it comes to Congress people in Congress, which, you know, for people, let's just define some terms here. If you're in Congress, that means you're a member of the House of Representatives or you're a senator.
That is correct.
And then also you have politicians, just anyone involved in government, maybe call it staff, some other position, doesn't matter, you're involved in government. These people, their sole duty is supposed to be to serve the people that they represent, their constituents. But you're saying that their number one mission, rather than serve the people and represent the people, is to get reelected. Now, what's the reason for that? Why do they want to get reelected so badly, in your opinion?
Well, a lot of them go out to Washington and they show up and they say, I'm going to drain the swamp. I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to do all this. And they get that to Washington and they get some free trips to different places for fact-finding missions, and everybody's so deferent to them and they have so much power, and people are coming into their office to kiss the ring, and they begin to feel their own self-importance, and eventually they say, you know, this really isn't a swamp. It's kind of like a hot tub, and I'm kind of liking it, and I want to stay. Because when you're in Congress, you get so many perks. You get so, there's so many things.
Such as what?
The respect and the power are, you know, power is intoxicating, and respect is intoxicating. Anywhere you go, you are the congressman, you are the honorable, you are introduced, you know, you have people waiting to see you, have high-powered people wanting to get into your office. You have this power, and again, people become intoxicated by it. So they want to stay, and it's their job. They've wanted to get into politics. You were a wrestler, right?
Yes, I was.
Did you ever want to lose?
No.
Did you ever go out on the mat and go, I don't care whether I win or lose. I really don't care whether I don't care whether I get this or not. They want to win their elections, and they want to keep moving up in the system. To go from state representative to Congress to Senate.
They want to keep
climbing the ladder, and they want to maintain that power, because that's the name of the game in politics, is maintaining that power.
In addition to, continue to enjoy all the luxuries that are granted to you as a person in Congress, such as paid travel, lots of paid travel. You know, you can go to Paris. If anything even remotely political is going on in Paris, you have an excuse to go there and call it a business trip or call it some type of research.
A fact-finding mission. You go out there and you can... Yeah. There are so many things that they are able to do with flights. One of the things in the book, and this is just a small thing, but they have their own parking places at the airport. Hmm. And they can book as many flights as they want to that day, the day they're coming home. And then if they don't show up, they're not charged for them. So and that's if they have to fly with a commercial airline. Generally, they're able to get some donor to say, well, let me fly you home. I've got to be out in Washington. Why don't you just ride home with me in my private jet? Well, that's great if you're a lobbyist, if you're a corporation and you can fly this person home on your corporate jet. They're just tagging along. They're just hitching a ride. Mm-hmm. Then you got them for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. You have them captive, and you can talk to them and say, look, I need some help with this bill. So it's one hand washing the other. And people don't want to go from being a congressman or a senator to being somebody that used to be somebody.
Dave's Supermarket in Fairbury is my favorite grocery store, not just in Central Illinois, but in the world. And for good reason. They have the most incredible customer service, friendly carryout workers, an exquisite and affordable bakery where fresh baked goods are prepared daily, and a deli market that is truly top-notch, that provides plenty of seating, delicious food, and even free coffee, if you can believe that. And their canned meats are out of this world. This is all just the tip of the iceberg, though, so if you haven't been here, you are really missing out. Come check out Dave's Supermarket in Fairbury, Illinois, where they've been wowing the customer for 72 years. And do you believe that most members of Congress feel this way? Like, oh, I don't want to go back to being a normal person. Do you think that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ted Cruz, and all the rest?
I believe they all want to maintain their power. Now, some of them would give up that power for term limits. There are some that are for term limits that they understand this, but it's a very, very small minority. And I think that the ones who are for term limits say, I know that we will never get term limits passed through Congress because there's so many people that are against them that I can be for it. And a lot of, and in a lot of cases, the folks in Congress will say, well, I'm for term limits. So they can propose a term limit amendment. They can propose term limits. And then what they propose may be five terms in the House and three terms in the Senate, or one term in the House and one term in the Senate, whatever. And then it gets voted down, or it doesn't get brought to the floor, but they can say, I proposed this. I brought this up. And then somebody else brings up something that's different, and they can vote against it or make sure that it doesn't get brought to the floor.
Everyone takes their turn, virtue signaling.
So everybody says, well, you know, I proposed a term limit. I proposed a resolution for that, yeah. but it was voted down. Well, you voted against others. Well, yes, because I thought that they were not restrictive enough, or for some reason I voted against them. But it's a game. It's something that they're able to do, and they can still sit there and say, I'm for term limits. But unfortunately, there wasn't enough people that agreed with me and my solution for term limits.
So what can these prolonged periods in Congress and in important positions in government, why are they problematic? Why some people would say that the experience you gain in being in Congress and holding your spot for 20 years, that experience and that wisdom that you gain is exactly what you need in order to do your job effectively. Why is that not the case? Why is it bad to be in there for so long? You know, ignore the, yes, they gain, they work up their way up the ladder, and they continue to enjoy more and more luxuries and privileges. Ignore that. Why is it bad for them to be in their positions for such a long time?
Because they no longer are serving the people. They're serving the people that put them in power. And you would think that that would be the voters, but it's truly not. It's the people that fund the campaigns. It's the lobbyists. It's the party, the people that are in charge of the state parties and that sort of thing. Those are the people that they're serving. When John McCain decided to retire, John McCain, who was against term limits, explained it very, very succinctly, and I don't think he even knew that he was doing it. But he said, now that I'm no longer running, I am free to do the right thing. Because if you're running, you're not necessarily free to do the right thing. You are bound to do the thing that will get you reelected. And getting you reelected is not always the right thing. So if a corporation comes in and says, we'll fund your next campaign, but we want variances on the environment, we want variances on whatever we want, whatever it is, and you say, okay, I'll vote for that, then you stay in power. You get to keep enjoying what you've got. And you can justify it by saying, well, I gave up this one thing, but I'm still able to do all these other things. And truly, you can justify anything in your mind if you try hard enough. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do.
Would you say that he who has the most campaign funds is typically the one that wins then?
Yes. Yes. Typically, that's the way that it works. The more money you have, the more you're able to get your name out, and the more notoriety, the more press, the more, you know, just name recognition. And that's what it is when people go in to vote. Unfortunately, our voters do not educate themselves, and that's why name recognition is really what you need. In the book, I talked about a game show that Drew Carey had. Do you remember reading that part in there?
Which game show?
It was. I don't recall the name of it because it wasn't very popular. It was very difficult to win. You had to guess a percentage. So a question might be, what percent of Americans live in a town that's less than 1,000 people? And you had to guess that. Well, you started out with a 10% range, and you finally got down to where you had to guess the exact percentage, and then I think you won $1 million or something like that. But it was very difficult to win, so it never really took off. But I saw an episode of it once, and he said, outside of California, where Arnold Schwarzenegger is the governor, so that shows you that it was quite some time ago, but outside of California, where Arnold Schwarzenegger is the governor, what percentage of Americans can name their sitting governor? Now think about that. All the people that work in politics, all the and every 4 years the governor has to run. So what percent do you think could name their sitting governor? All, you know, there's pictures at the DMV. Sure. Pictures on checks of state employees.
Headlines in the newspaper, articles.
So how many people?
Think you would hope at least 80%. I would, if I'm honest, I would say of adults over the age of, people over the age of 18, 50%, 60%. I hope it's not less than that.
Go a little lower.
40?
Go a little lower.
30?
Go a little lower.
Nah, no way. 20?
Go a little lower.
If it's less than 10.
It was 16.
So, okay.
16% can name their sitting governor. So if only 16% of the people can name their sitting governor, what chance do you have of understanding, as a voter, understanding all the differences between the people that are running for office?
Sure. And it costs so much money to get your name in front of them. You have to pay so much money for marketing. To get commercials, I've made commercials for businesses in the area. It's a pricey endeavor to get them on local TV stations, let alone across the country. You need millions and millions of dollars.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I read something that the race between Sharon Chung and Scott Preston is going to be just enormously expensive for a House race, an Illinois House race here in, I think it's the 91st. And they're just going to pour enormous amounts of money into this for an Illinois state representative.
Mm.
But they got to do it in order to get that out there. So one of the things that the lack of term limits has done is it's caused this gerrymandering, so that they can gerrymander and put people in districts that are safe, have just a few that are in play, and then pour all that money into the ones that are in play. So let's take a district like the district with Mary Miller and Rodney Davis.
Really quick, for the people that might not know, can you explain what gerrymandering is and how often they get the opportunity to practice this?
Every 10 years, you redraw districts. So you do this after the census. And the reason
Which is every 10 years.
Every
as well.
10 years. So after the census, they come out and they redraw the districts to reflect the change in population. So now the politicians have said, okay, well, if we're going to redraw this, then we are the party in power. Well, let's draw this to benefit us. And it is possible to take and draw maps so that 40% of the people have 60% of the representation. If you draw the maps right. And what they'll do is they'll take and they'll put as many of one party into a district as possible. So the district that Mary Miller and Rodney Davis is in for U.S. Congress, it starts down towards St. Louis, and then it comes up along I-55 to the east of I-55, and to the west of I-55, there's this little sliver that goes from East St. Louis up to Springfield, then over to Decatur, and then over to Champaign.
It's an oddly drawn shape, isn't it? It's very skinny and
That one's very skinny, but that's just like a little sliver that's cut out of the bigger district, because the district that Miller and Davis were just going for goes from over around Terre Haute, Indiana, almost up to the Quad Cities, and it goes over to Quincy, but it doesn't have Champaign, Springfield, and Decatur in it. So if you were going to drive around that district, you'd have to drive miles and miles and miles in order to get around that district, or you could just cut across the little sliver of district that comes up. It's about 10 miles wide in some places. So it was drawn strictly for political purposes. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with geography or anything like that. They drew it so that it would be 65% Republican. They jam all those Republican votes into one district. Well, what that's done then is it made that primary extremely competitive, because whoever won that primary is absolutely going to win the general election. That's a given, because there's 65% Republicans, 35% Democrats. No Democrat's going to win that, much in the same way that a Republican is not going to go win some of the districts that are drawn in Chicago, because they've drawn them so that a Democrat will win. So now Mary Miller won that primary. Mary Miller is probably going to be in Congress for as long as she wants to be. Mm-hmm. That until they redraw the districts, if they draw her out again, that's what they did this time. The Democrats drew her out of that district. But if you're in a district, if you're in a safe district, then you can stay there forever. And they do. Don Young recently passed away. He was the congressman from Alaska, and he was there for 50 years. You can't tell me that he would have won his 25th race if that would have been his first race. Mm-hmm. He was not the best person for the job, kind of like me running against Usain Bolt. I'm not the fastest guy, but if I've got that 95-yard head start, then I win the race.
The tractor cab is the mission control of the entire farming operation. Worn out and outdated tractor cabs lead to annoying discomfort, hindered productivity, dangerous sound levels, and lower resale value. This is why you need to revive your tractor cab with Fair Cab Interiors. Today, we use our vast facility in the cornfields of Illinois to manufacture high-quality custom tractor upholstery for over 750 models from the 1960s all the way through to the 2010s. Our team of product engineers carefully design each new part, emphasizing product fit and ease of installation for anyone to install. We offer acoustical foam panels, ProForm plastic panels, headliners, floor mats, door and window seals, seats, and much more. We carefully monitor lamination quality, use premium grade foam, and utilize the highest standards of raw materials when manufacturing. With our massive inventory and delivery trucks that pick up daily, logistics are a snap. Our call center is manned not by robot answering machines, but real, experienced, and knowledgeable people who will provide you with installation tips, product details, and help with any questions you may have before or after the sale. But don't just take our word for all this. See what people are saying on faircab.com and Google Reviews, where we've earned over 2,000 five-star reviews.
When the time comes to fix up your aging tractor interior, try out the cab interior experts at Fair Cab. Visit us at faircab.com or give us a call at 815-692-3355.
Term limits will fix or lessen nearly every problem that there is. And one guy said to me, he says, okay, will term limits fix potholes? I said, yeah, they will. They'll fix potholes. And this guy, oh, come on, you can't tell me that. And I said, no, think about this. You ever heard of a bridge to nowhere?
Only from reading your book, but.
Yeah, so a bridge to nowhere, you know, people will take and they'll put a pork project, a construction project, back in their district. They can come home and say, I brought this back.
They'll attach their name to it.
So this is the Scott Murphy Bridge that goes over this river that there's really nothing on either side, but I got us a bridge. And then we might put some roads in to be able to connect up with that bridge. And it really doesn't do the good that money could have done somewhere else. But it is the Scott Murphy Bridge. And then every time somebody drives over that, they see the Scott Murphy Bridge. And they remember the name Scott Murphy. And then when I'm on the ballot and they see the name Scott Murphy, they vote for me. Now, if we didn't have term limits, then instead of building a bridge to nowhere, if Scott Murphy has to come back from Washington and live amongst us and be subject to the laws that are passed in Congress, they'll pass different laws, because I would much rather have potholes fixed if I'm going to be driving on it than a bridge to nowhere. And if they build that bridge to nowhere in my last term, then I'm not even going to be around to see it christened and opened. They're probably going to put somebody else's name on it, so somebody else is going to have, they're going to be driving over somebody else's bridge, and I'm going to be driving over potholes. So I'm going to fix the potholes, because I know I have to come back and live amongst the people that elected me, and I'm going to have to come back and drive on their roads. I'm going to have to be subject to their lifestyle rather than the lifestyle out in Washington, D.C.
Right. It's all too easy and tempting to pass self-serving laws that hurt the general public, especially if you're not going to be a member of the general public and you're not going to have to live through the consequences of that legislation that you passed. It's weird that people who don't even have to abide by these laws or these things, you know, such as not fixing the potholes, they don't have to suffer that. And also, there's a strong case to be made that they're outside of the laws that they pass as well. And we'll talk about that eventually. But it's just a weird concept that because there are no term limits, they can be free to, for such a long time, not bear the consequences, not live with the consequences of the decisions that they make.
Absolutely. And then you also think about this. Excuse me. They're passing the campaign laws. So when it comes time to campaign, there's a lot of laws, but they're passed by the incumbents. So who do you think those laws favor?
The incumbents.
Absolutely. In baseball, if you let the pitchers write the rules, there probably would never be a hit again, because the pitchers would say, okay, you know, we're going to move the mound, we're going to raise the mound, we're going to move the mound closer, we're going to make all these changes so that it benefits the pitchers. And if you let the batters write the rules, you know, the batter's going to move the pitchers back 5 feet, going to drop the mound down to nothing, we're going to have home runs going out of the park like crazy, and the pitchers would hate it. So with Congress, they get to write the rules. The incumbents get to write the rules. And all the rules that they write are to benefit them. If you were writing rules, you'd write them to benefit yourself too.
It's in our nature, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Especially when it's in terms of a long-term career.
Absolutely.
You want this to benefit you as long as it can, as well as it can.
Absolutely.
Just human nature.
Absolutely. So when they say, and this is one of the laziest arguments against term limits, well, we already have term limits. They're called elections.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, again, that's that 90-yard or 100-yard dash where the incumbent gets a 95-yard head start, and you say, well, okay, we're having a race. You know, both of you start at the same time. Both of you finish at the same place. What's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with it is one guy gets a 95-yard head start. It's just the nature of it. And you really can't take that away. There's really not a way to take away that incumbent advantage. I've heard people say, well, we need to get the money out of politics. If we limit the money, then that will eliminate the need for term limits. And it will not, because people will, with the franking privilege that the incumbents can use to send mail back, and the person who's been on the ballot, whose name is in the paper, who they are out promoting themselves, you take away the money, now the challenger, you know, they've got nothing. They don't have the ability to go out. They got to buy name recognition, whereas the incumbent can just exploit their position to get it.
Something really interesting that I've heard is that, you know, turkeys wouldn't vote for Thanksgiving.
Yes.
So, of course, Congress won't pass laws that would limit the terms that they can serve, since they do benefit so much from not having term limits, just like a turkey would benefit so much from not having Thanksgiving.
Absolutely.
It keeps them alive.
Absolutely.
It keeps them living the way that they want to live. I'm a bit of a tone switch here, topic switch. I really liked in your book how you likened the political arena in Congress to that of the WWE or the WWF,
right,
in your example.
Right, right.
You talked about, I thought this was great, because I love wrestling. I love the sport, the real sport of wrestling.
Right.
And I also, when I was a kid, I enjoyed WWE a lot.
Who didn't?
Right, yeah. Well, The Undertaker, one of the best moments in WWE history is when he, in like a Hell in a Cell match or something, maybe,
right,
at WrestleMania, it was The Undertaker versus Mick Foley.
Yep.
They're both on top of the cage, 20 feet high. The Undertaker choke slams Mankind, or Mick Foley, whatever,
right,
his name was, off of the cage.
Right.
And it's incredible. These two hate each other. The crowd's going wild. The commentators are enthusiastically saying, oh, he's a monster. He killed him. He's broken in half. This is pandemonium. It's total bedlam here. And the people are just consumed by this. and you think the Undertaker hates Mick Foley, and that's the storyline.
Right.
However, if you listen closely, you can hear the Undertaker saying, "Are you okay?" to Mick Foley.
Well, the Undertaker stood on top of that cage and looked down at him, and Foley was knocked out. Because, yes, professional wrestling is not... If professional wrestling is scripted to a degree, the outcome is predetermined. But I guarantee if you take me up on top of a cage, 20-foot cage, and throw me off and I hit the table, the commentator's table, it's going to hurt. And so that part of it is real to a degree, because you can't throw somebody off a 20-foot cage without hurting them. When he hit the bottom, it knocked him out. They brought out a stretcher, and his arch enemy, Terry Funk, who Foley and Terry Funk had traveled the world together, beating up on each other with baseball bats wrapped in barbed wire, Funk comes, he broke character, comes running out of the back, and Foley's on a stretcher, and he's, "Mick, are you okay? Are you trying to get him, trying to revive
him? Get him to show him some signs of life."
Right, right, because he was concerned that Foley was dead. A lot of people were, because they didn't know what was going to happen. I read Foley's book, and he talked a lot about this, about how he talked the Undertaker into throwing him off the top of this cell. So people didn't know what was going on, and when he threw him off the top of the cell, and all these guys are in the back going, "Oh my God, you can't throw a guy off a 20-foot cell onto a table." And so Foley comes running out. Foley should have been beating the hell out of him, because Foley and he hated each other, but in reality, they were best friends. They mm-hmm. were. They were best friends.
And but to the people, they were arch enemies.
Because that's what the show was. And that kept them relevant. So Foley and Funk were both very relevant in the WWE because of their hatred for one another.
Right.
So now let's go to Congress. And you have two people in Congress who are on opposite sides of the aisle, and they're on opposite sides of an issue. And they can stand there and they can beat their chest and they can yell and scream. And let's say it's you and me. And I say, "I'm the only guy that can keep you, that can keep Paul Garcia and his crazy ideas in check. I'm the only guy that can make this work. I will be there to make sure that this guy doesn't take away your rights." And my people will go crazy and they'll go, "Oh, yeah, that's great, that's great." And you go back to your state or your district or wherever you're from, and you go, "Murphy, he will be the end of this country. He will be the..." And you just yell and scream, and your people will go, "Ah, all right, we got to send Paul back." And then as soon as the cameras are over, then I go, "Hey, Paul, you want to go get something to eat?" "Yeah, sure. Hey, you and the wife and kids want to come down to the lake this weekend?" Yeah. And because you and I make one another relevant by putting on that show, you and I make one another. And without you, then there is no me. Just like without Terry Funk, there was no Mankind. So it's that show that they're putting on for the people so that they can get reelected and stay relevant.
And then the comparison even gets better when you consider the commentators in the WWE, Jim Ross going crazy.
Absolutely.
And everyone loving his commentary.
Absolutely.
And then you look at Fox News and CNN, and they're the commentators, and
absolutely,
they're going crazy, and they're making these two supposed arch enemies even more relevant. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely,
then they go, and then you see them on the weekend golfing together. People wonder, what's that about? Well, it's a fact-finding mission. Maybe
right,
you can tell us
right,
what a fact-finding right, mission is.
It's whatever you want it to be. A fact-finding mission can be whatever you want it to be.
Fairbury Furniture is Central Illinois' premier furniture store. This family-owned business offers a vast selection of premium furniture items from all of your favorite brands, including Sealy, Best Home Furnishings, Leather Italia, Tempur-Pedic, and Ashley, just to name a few. And right next door to their gorgeous 7,000-square-foot furniture showroom, you will find the Fairbury Furniture Mattress Store, home to all of the latest and greatest mattresses in any and all sizes. Also inside Fairbury Furniture is the popular WC Market, a beloved shop that offers an ever-changing selection of unique gifts and fashionable home decor. So make your home interior beautiful, comfortable, stylish, and delightful when you shop at Fairbury's own Fairbury Furniture.
Come on down to Fairbury Furniture, where the furniture rocks.
So if you want to take a trip to Africa, well, I need to go to Africa to check out what's going on with the mining of lithium because we have all these new electric batteries. So I need to go over there. So, you know, because of this, I need to go there. Or I need to go to France to find out what the, to talk to people there because with a Brexit, this is a very dangerous time. So I've got to get to Paris and my wife's got to come along, or I've got to get to London or I got to take a rafting trip down the Colorado River because, I got to see they're talking about how the water flow isn't there. So I need to get on that river and see for myself, or I got to go out here and go fly fishing, or I got to, whatever you want to do. Fact-finding mission is whatever you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And they go on these all the time. So they can do what they want to do.
And they're subsidized by taxpayer dollars, aren't they?
They're either subsidized by taxpayer dollars, or they are subsidized by a lobbyist who says, well, they're saying that the agriculture in California is taking a lot of water out of the Colorado River. Why don't you come out here and I'll show you that that's not true. Let me bring you out here and show you, and you go whitewater rafting and you bring your family, and then we'll go fly fishing and we'll go do this and we'll go do that, and you'll be able to see exactly what I'm saying, that no, that water level looks pretty good to me. And then you go out and you go, oh yeah, I was out there. And then you can come back and you can go, I was on the ground there. I stood in that river. I really took my job seriously. Yeah, did you?
Right. One thing with term limits that I think is extremely interesting, and it's not a surprise to anyone when I say this, because we all see it, but maybe we haven't heard it be clearly articulated, is the sheer age of people in Congress. There are a lot of old people. I mean, we see it all the time. Maxine Waters, representative from California, 83. Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, 89. There's been plenty of 90-year-old plus people in Congress as well. And in your book, this is incredible. This book is extremely well written, too. I highly recommend people go read it. But in your book, you mentioned the owner of a pharmacy who delivers pharmaceuticals to Congress.
Yes.
He listed Alzheimer's as one of the conditions treated by the drugs that he delivered right to Congress.
Yeah.
That means someone has medication for Alzheimer's who's in Congress. How could anyone of significantly declining cognition continue to be reelected? And what's this all mean to you? What do you have to say about this? That's incredible.
Well, Strom Thurmond was reelected. He was serving in Congress. He was reelected at 94, so he was serving in Congress at 100. So this guy, they're wheeling him around in a wheelchair. But you think about this, and this is why it all makes sense what they're doing, because people would look and go, "Well, if you're losing function, then why would you want to stay?" So let's say you're my chief of staff. And I'm getting old, and I'm starting to have mental impairment. I'm starting to get a little dementia, being forgetful. But I trust you. You're my chief of staff. You're my guy. You know, you've been with me for a long time. So if you go and you say, "Hey, Murph's losing it, man. This guy's getting out there. We need to get him out." Then what happens to you as soon as I resign?
I'm out of a job.
You're out of a job.
And a paycheck, more importantly.
You're out of a paycheck. You're out of a job. But more importantly, you're no longer relevant. You are you're somebody that used to be somebody. On the other hand, if you take and you keep me going, you keep propping me up, you keep saying, "Oh, no, he's fine. Everything's good. But if you want to talk to Scott, just tell me what you want, and I'll go back and talk to him." Well, you're my guy, so I trust you. So you come in, you go, "Hey, Scott, you need to vote yes on this bill." Okay, I'll vote yes on it. And then you're the one who's calling the shots. So you're going to protect me at all costs. You're going to shield me. You're not going to let me answer questions in press conferences. You're going to limit the press conferences. You're going to limit me being out in front of anybody because you don't want to see me drooling around and wetting my pants. You know, you don't want that. You want people to believe that I'm still doing well. And so you keep propping me up. And that's why people stay there. And then if you're running for re-election, Strom Thurmond at 94, I mean, how many doors could this guy knock on? He was in a wheelchair. How many doors could he knock on? How many things could he go to? But he had been in Congress for so long that this guy couldn't be eliminated. They couldn't vote him out because people just knew his name and they would vote for him.
Hmm. Very interesting.
And again, it's that only 16% of the people can name their sitting governor, but they will recognize the name of the governor when you put it in front of them. And that's a key thing. If they had to write down the name on a ballot, it would be a very different thing. But as it is, you just check, and people will check the name that they recognize.
Right. Absolutely they will. I mean, all the time when I go vote, usually I know at least one person almost personally when it comes to the local elections, especially who is running, and I either like them or I don't like them. And well, I could see how someone might not know anyone who's running for a given position. They might just vote for the person whose name they've heard.
Right.
Despite not really knowing anything about them. It's because they know the name that they're going to vote and they want to think that they know something, that they made an intelligent decision. Hey, I know this person. Maybe I don't really know anything they're about, but I know them.
But I
hear their name.
But I recognize their name.
You're gonna go with the person that's familiar. You always go with the thing that's familiar. In a world of unknowns, you're gonna go with what's familiar.
Absolutely. So people want you to just recognize that name when you go into the polls. And that's what the incumbent advantage, that's one of the things that comes along with the power of incumbency, is they recognize your name. Mm-hmm. You might not be able to name that many people in Congress, but if we gave you a list and we said, is this person in Congress or not, you'd get a whole lot more right than what you think, because you'd go, oh yeah, I've heard that guy. Oh, I've heard of that person. I've heard of that person. And you could go down and you could check them off that way. And that's one of the things, the power of incumbency, is that name recognition.
And term limits would prevent that name recognition due to such a prolonged period of time in office.
It would eliminate the advantage that the incumbent has. So the thing that will benefit the public with term limits is we will have a Congress that actually tries to get something done. Because right now the Congress benefits from a status quo. After World War II, there were a group of people that were Nazi hunters, and they were going out and they were hunting down Nazi war criminals. Well, what does the Nazi hunter do when the last Nazi's found? You know, they've worked themselves out of a job.
Right.
So Congress, if they really fix problems, then they could work themselves out of a job. Because if somebody went to Congress and said, I am going to, you know, pick a topic. If you say, I'm going to get semi-automatic rifles banned. I'm going to get the military, you know, whatever they want to call it. I'm going to get that ban put in. That's my whole shtick. I'm getting that in. I'm going to get that in. That's my whole thing. I'm going to do it. Well, once you get it done.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. You know, you're sitting here going, oh, okay. Well, now what do I do? Now I got to come up with a whole new shtick and I'm not sure that I can do it. So I may be voted out. So that's why I get the guy that is very pro-gun and the guy that's very anti-gun, and we can butt heads and we can just keep fighting as hard as we can and not rest and working 24/7, 365 to try and do all this, when in reality, you're keeping me relevant and I'm keeping you relevant.
People love a good fight. It's entertaining.
People love a fight. It's entertaining. And you haven't found that last Nazi yet, so you're not out of a job. You haven't fixed the problem. So Congress, they don't fix problems. And the other thing is, pick any topic. So
abortion.
Okay. So abortion. If abortion is banned completely, then those who are pro-choice will rise up with enormous fury. And they will throw out the people who have banned abortion because they're going to be very angry. And the people who are anti-abortion are going to say, okay, cool, you did a good job, thank you very much, and they're not going to be as passionate. They're not going to be have that rage.
People fight hard, but they don't maintain hard.
Right, right, exactly. So if they get something done, then those who get it done, they're probably going to be out. So if they banned abortion, the ones who banned it would be out. If they came in and said abortion is legal, it's government funded, on demand, anytime up until the very instant of birth, then those who are anti-abortion are going to be furious. They're going to throw those people out. So if you actually do something, then you're going to lose your job.
Right.
So you're better off to just keep fighting like Mick Foley and Mankind, keep each other relevant, stay in the hot tub that some people call a swamp, and just stay there forever.
Right, and make everyone on both sides believe that their ideologies and beliefs are being threatened and what they stand for is being threatened without actually eliminating that which they stand for.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if you want something done, you need to have people come in that you say, you've got X amount of time to get it done, and then you're done. And they're either going to get it done or they're not. But if they get it done, the difference between because in the book we call for 3 terms in Congress, 6 years. So the difference between 4 years and 6 years is not all that great. The difference between 4 years and 50 years, well, that's a career. Mm-hmm. So if you get something done in 4 years and then they vote you out the next term, well, you were going to be out in 2 years anyway. It's not that big a deal. So if you want something done, we have to get people in there that it is in their best interest to get it done. And again, going back to the first thing that I said was, their number one priority is to get reelected. And getting something done is not how you get reelected. Mm-hmm. It's not getting something done that gets you reelected.
And so how can we make it so their number one priority is not just to get reelected?
Term limits. That's the only way. Now, a lot of people are out there and they're saying, okay, this is great, but these guys are never going to vote for term limits. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to. The states can call for an Article 5 convention. So it's a constitutional convention. And 34 states call for a convention, then a convention will be convened. And at that convention, they can discuss term limits. Now, it's the opinion of the lawyers for U.S. term limits that a convention can be called for one topic and one topic only.
This constitutional convention among the states where at least 34 states have to call for it, and then there's a big meeting at one place, one physical place where all the states come together.
Where the states send representatives, and they bring them in, and then they vote on whether they're going to call for this constitutional amendment or not. And when they vote for the amendment, if it passes the constitutional convention, then it goes back to the states. And then 38 states have to ratify that.
Okay. And ratify means basically put it into the Constitution.
To ratify it, you have to vote on it. So the states get to vote, say, we want that or we don't.
Right.
So there's a good checks and balance system here. And I've had people tell me, well, I'm afraid that they're going to hijack the Constitutional Convention. That the right says, oh, my God, they're going to hijack it and they're going to say abortion's legal. And the left says, oh, my God, they're going to hijack it and they're going to outlaw abortion, or they're going to take all our guns, or they're going to do this, or they're going to do that. There is no issue that can pass a constitutional convention that's polarized like that, because if they want to take away all their guns and say, we're going to ban guns completely in the United States, I guarantee you that there is at least 13 states that are going to go, there's no way you're doing that. If they say, we're going to ban abortion, I guarantee you there's 13 states that'll say, no, we're not doing that. So that constitutional amendment does not pass. So the convention really cannot be hijacked.
Right.
Because our states are too polarized right now. So if they did say, yeah, we're going to ban guns, or we're going to make it concealed carry, no, nothing, you just, you know, anybody, any citizen, anywhere can carry concealed. You know, you look at New York and California and New Jersey and Rhode Island and Delaware, and you know, those states are going to say, no, we're not going to pass that. And if they say we're going to ban guns completely, you look at Arkansas and Kentucky and Tennessee, Mississippi, Missouri, Indiana, Montana. I mean, you know, you just go down through the states, you'll find 13 that'll go, no, we're not voting for that. And then it does not become part of the Constitution.
Sure. Okay, so help me understand this a little more deeply. Ratification, I understood that to be the official installment of an amendment into the Constitution. It is ratified, therefore at that moment is officially a part of the Constitution.
Yes.
Okay, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then if Congress doesn't pass an amendment, the ratification of an amendment, I guess, if they won't do it, if they won't...
They don't have to.
Right. If they won't, though, that's when it can go back to the states. And if 34 states say, hey, we want to have a constitutional convention,
yes,
they can get together. And if all 34 say, yep, we want term limits, all right, done deal, let's send it back to the states. And then 38 have to get back and say, yep, we're all for it. And once 38 give them the stamp of approval, give that amendment the stamp of approval of term limits, then it would become... An amendment
to
it
the
would
Constitution.
Be ratified.
It would say...
No Congress needed.
So what I think would happen is if the states got together and they started to call for a constitutional convention, I think you would very quickly see Congress come in and say, okay, we're going to make an amendment of our own, and we're going to do it faster. So they would get it done as they're seeing, oh my God, it looks like this, there could be this convention that we don't want to lose our power. So they would come in then and say, all right, we're going to pass this, but we're going to grandfather ourselves in. So anybody who is elected prior to gets to stay. Now, that's not perfect, okay? But very few things in politics are. So if they say we're going to grandfather ourselves in 50 years, term limits are official. Everybody's term limited, because they're not going to last longer than 50 years. AOC she could be here till 2076 if she stays until she's Nancy Pelosi's age. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a reason we need term limits right there. But eventually we would get rid of all those people. So my point is that's better than nothing, because if our parents and grandparents had done that for us, we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
Right.
If our parents and grandparents had done that for us, we'd have term limits. So do we owe it to our children and our grandchildren to pass this today to make sure that they have it later on?
Perhaps. Okay. And now if Congress passes their modified version of a term limits amendment, could the states still get together and pass their own more strict version?
They could. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. I do know that Congress would have to send their version back to the states and have 38 states ratify it. Congress can't ratify it themselves, so they'd have to send it back to the states. So there'd be 38 states, and the states might say, "You know what? We're not going to ratify yours. We're going to ratify our own." Mm. So there could be a tipping point here where Congress says, look, folks, we're in trouble. This term limit thing has really gotten some steam behind it, and they're going to get something done. And we've put them off as long as we can. We've fought the good fight, but it's obvious we're losing. And it's very big would lose because 92% of the people want term limits.
Hmm. That's incredible. What a vast majority.
It's the one thing that could unite the country. You know, we're fighting about guns, we're fighting about abortion, we're fighting about immigration, we're fighting about all these things. But that's kind of distraction to make sure that they stay in. They don't want us getting together. They don't want us happy. They don't want us getting along. Because if we do get along, then their power to control us and their power to remain in power is threatened greatly.
It really does sound sinister. And when I read your book, you don't talk in apocalyptic language at all. You simply reveal facts. And I even watched some 60 Minutes documentaries on this subject. And it's really incredible because it's true that they want to stay in power, as far as I can see. And that's weird to see elected officials in government. You think the people in government mean the best and they're really, really smart and they just want the best for the people of America. But it's not hard to see that truly their incentive, they want to stay in power. They're kind of drunk on power.
Absolutely.
And it's not like they're necessarily making millions of their salaries are approximately $175,000, which is nothing to sneeze at, but it's not, you wouldn't kill someone over it. You wouldn't do incredibly illegal things necessarily to preserve that. But there are other forms of income, I guess.
Well, there are. And we'll get to that in just a little bit. But when you say it sounds sinister, I am not alleging any vast conspiracy where they have secret, there's a secret room under the Capitol and they get on the first night of the full moon, they gather. Yeah, none of that stuff. It's just human nature that they're in power and they want to keep it. And they don't all get together and say, oh, we're gonna do this to maintain our power and we're going to keep these people fighting. I don't believe there's this vast conspiracy out there. I think it's just when you get people who have a common interest, they don't have to have a vast conspiracy because they're all acting in that common interest. And so the politicians who want to stay in power, they're all doing the same thing to try and stay in power. And since they're the ones who write the rules, they're the ones that get to stay in power.
Let's talk about money really quick.
Okay.
Members of Congress have long made incredible profits from trading stocks based on inside information.
Yes.
This is not a secret. This has been illegal for CEOs, but legal for Congress. Illegal for financial advisors, but legal for members of Congress. And it's really strange. And senators, this is incredible. Senators still regularly outperform Warren Buffett, a financial guru, by several magnitudes in their stock profit percentages. Either they're incredible experts or they know inside information, and that determines when they buy and when they sell. Now, I'm told that this is illegal to do now after the Stock Act of 2012,
yes,
signed,
yes,
by President Barack Obama, but is that not the case?
Then they gutted it and they made it almost impossible to enforce. I'm not an attorney to be able to give you all the nuances of how they gutted it. But again, those who write the rules win.
And a lot of them are lawyers.
And a lot of them are lawyers. And so they wrote this act and then they gutted it to the point that it really can't be enforced. So if you're sitting on the defense committee and we're going to get a new jet fighter and you've got Lockheed and you got Boeing and they're both going for this project, and it's a huge project, and you know, well, we're going with Boeing, but it hasn't been announced yet, and you go out and buy Boeing stock, then when the announcement comes, up goes Boeing stock, and you make a lot of money. And so that's exactly how they do it. But if the thing is, if I was a senator and I knew that Boeing was going to get this contract, and you and I are at lunch, and I say, "Oh yeah, I gotta get back. I gotta make sure we get all the I's dotted and T's crossed on this Boeing contract." And you go, "Oh, Boeing's getting the new fighter." Yep. And then you go buy stock. Then you go to prison. Now me, I get reelected, but you know, and I get to use some of that money in my reelection campaign.
Right.
So, yeah, it's incredible what they did. One of the things, and this ties in a couple of parts of it, of the book, when Denny Hastert was a wrestling coach at Yorkville High School. And in fact, Denny coached against me in the U-High tournament and the Yorkville takedown tournament. I wrestled his chief of staff's brother back in the day. So Denny was a math teacher and a high school wrestling coach. And then he went down to Springfield to be a state representative down there. I don't recall if someone retired or what happened, but there was a vacancy in his district for Congress. So he came back and ran and won. So now he's a congressman in Washington, D.C. Well, as a high school wrestling coach, he wasn't making that much. As a congressman in, or a representative in the Illinois House, he wasn't making that much. So then he's a congressman out there, and he's a congressman for a few years. And like you said, he's making 175, wasn't making that much then, probably 130, something like that. Excuse me. And so he becomes Speaker of the House. So he's
doing, working up the ladder. Speaker of the House, geez, huge deal.
He's doing well with that. And then the Republicans lost the House, and then Denny retires. So now he's no longer a congressman. And then he gets in trouble for structuring on his bank account, where he's taken out a lot of money. He's taken out a lot of money, more than $10,000 cash out of his bank account.
On a regular basis. On a regular basis. On a scheduled basis, which is a red flag for... Yeah.
Well, he was taking out more than 10, so the IRS came and said, what are you doing? And he had some reason for it, and then they said, okay, well, you know, no big deal. Then they saw that he was taking like $9,000 out every week or so. So that was the structuring, taking out less than 10, but doing it on a regular basis to avoid the $10,000. And it came to find out he was being blackmailed, and he had agreed to pay $3 million, I believe, to someone who was blackmailing him over some things that happened while he was a high school coach. And so he's paying these people off, and that's how he got caught, was with that.
Can we say what he did?
He was, he molested a boy while he was a high school coach.
And he was paying, he agreed to pay like $3.5 million over the course of a period of time to a family member.
Something like that. Yes, yes, yep. So he agrees to pay this, and he wound up going to prison for it. Now, my thought on this is, and this is a question that I never heard anybody ask, and I never heard anybody from Congress ask this question. I never heard anybody bring this up at all. And that is, where in the hell did he get that money? $3.5 million. I mean, come on. If you know a secret about me and you say, I'm going to tell the world if you don't give me $3.5 million, I'll give you my cell phone. Because, you know, there you go, bud. You know, because I can't stop you because I can't get three. How did he get $3.5 million? Well, nobody in Congress said, where did that money come from? Nobody in the press said, where did that money come from? Everybody said, oh, that's not the Denny that we know. Thoughts and prayers with the victims, you know, all this kind of thing.
From both sides too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the Democrats now, they had a shot. They could come in and go, look at this guy. Look at what happened. Well, now it's real. Kind of like when Mick Foley went off the top of the cage into the table. Now it's real. He's hurt. He is truly hurt. And his arch enemy comes out to make sure he's okay. So Denny is now in trouble. And everybody circled the wagons. They all came around going, oh, you know, we're not going to comment on this until we know what's going on. They have no problem commenting on anything and shooting from the hip on rumors that they pick up on Facebook.
Right, right.
But in this case here, oh, no, 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 this is real. So we're not getting involved in anything that's real.
Let's not look too closely at the phenomena of people in Congress doing illegal, weird things and paying large sums of money.
And having large sums of money. Mm-hmm. Where did that money come from?
Yeah, don't look over here. Don't look at this.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's like the magician who he wants to have you looking away from what he's doing, so when he does something, it'll look phenomenal. So here this guy, where did the money come from? Where did it come from? Nobody has said anything about where it came from. And that's why people want to stay in Congress, is because, you know, you get blackmailed for $3.5 million, you can actually pony it up. If you're a working stiff and you get blackmailed for $3.5 million, you got nothing, you know. So that's one of the reasons why people want to stay in Congress, and that's one of the things that Congress, you know, they're there to help one another out, because, you know, if I scratch your back, you'll scratch mine later on. And the other thing with people is, if you and I are rivals in Congress, you and I are known commodities to one another. If you lose in a primary, I got no idea who I'm dealing with. I got no idea who the next person's going to be. I know how I can deal with you. You and I have an arrangement. But, you know, the next person may not be that way. And this is one of the things that this is another argument that people throw up against term limits. And this is another very lazy, looks good on a bumper sticker, but doesn't stand up to scrutiny. If we pass term limits, then we will have inexperienced people in Congress, and those people will be more easily manipulated by the lobbyists and the unelected bureaucrats that inhabit Washington, D.C. So we need experienced people in there who can fend off the lobbyists. And that sounds kind of reasonable. You know, I mean, it really does. Until you really think about it and you say, well, why are lobbyists so against term limits then? Do you think that the gun lobby and the teachers union and the auto lobby and the pharmaceutical lobby and the defense lobby, all those guys on K Street are sitting around going, well, we got to make sure we don't get term limits because we just get too much power. Mm-hmm. They are so against term limits, and it's because it would limit their power.
Right.
Jack Abramanoff said, of course lobbyists are against. He was a huge, high-powered lobbyist who wound up going to prison. But he said, of course we're against term limits. Once you buy a congressman, you don't want to have to turn around and buy another one every few years. Nick Tumbelides, who wrote that piece that you started out with about Congress and the head lice and all that. He did that in a testimony before the Senate.
Yeah, Ted video Cruz has over a million views on YouTube. It's really exceptional.
Yeah, that guy's amazing. He wrote the foreword to the book. I love him. He is one of the most quick-witted people I've ever met. And he says, every morning I come into the office, I make coffee, I pour myself a cup, and I get another cup out, and I go to my desk, and I start working. And I've got that other cup there sitting there waiting, ready to go, because I'm waiting for the day that a lobbyist comes in and says, I want to help you pass term limits. And he says, I have never had to wash that cup. So the lobbyists and bureaucrats hate the idea of term limits because they don't want to upset the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they'll also be out of a sweet connection that brings them a lot of deals. And explain to me, what is a lobbyist? I roughly know.
Okay, so a lobbyist there's a lot of lobbying firms in Washington, D.C. But a lobbyist is basically someone who cozies up to a congressman with the intent of influencing him, or any politician. So a lobbyist, anybody can lobby. I have friends on the county board. So if I went to a friend on a county board and I said, hey, you know, we got this ordinance coming up and this is what this is how you need to vote. In my opinion, this is, you know, why this is a good thing or a bad thing. Then I'm lobbying that person.
You're attempting to persuade. It must be a synonym.
You're going to attempt to persuade. Now, if for instance, there was wind farms come in. If the wind farms came to me and said, hey, Scott, you know this guy on the county board. We'll give you $10,000 if you can persuade them to vote our way. Now, I can't go give that guy $10,000, but I can go use my influence that I have with them to try and convince them to vote that way. So in Washington, there are lobbying firms where you can hire this lobbying firm, and then they will go use all their connections with all these Congress folks to try and get legislation passed.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So if I own a wind farm in Washington, D.C., or just anywhere, I can go to a firm that's a lobbying firm and say, hey, I'd really like to see something passed that can grow or be beneficial to my wind farm, such as some environmental act.
Exactly. Or
will subsidize farms like mine.
Or the manufacturer of windmills.
Mm.
They stand to make a lot of money if they subsidize the wind farms. And if those subsidies are taken away, then they don't make that much money. So the wind farms, then they have a lobby and they go out and they lobby and they try to persuade Congress to subsidize wind farms.
So if I own that wind farm manufacturer or windmill manufacturer, and I would go to this firm, this lobbying firm, and say, I would like such and such done. What can you do? They'd say, oh, what do you think, guys? $10,000 and we'll go put in a good...
More like $50
million. $50 million. We'll put in a good word for you. We'll go to the Capitol today or next week and talk to these guys and just try to persuade them.
Yes.
They must have a high level of success.
Yes. Very, very high level.
How is this not illegal? And then they just keep the money.
Yes.
The lobbyists.
Well, they may have to spend some for some fact-finding missions.
Oh, yeah.
They may have to make some campaign contributions. They may have to... Why is it legal? Because those who write the rules win. If you take away one thing from what I'm saying here today, those who write the rules win. And Congress writes the rules so that they can have these people come and try to persuade them and go on these fact-finding. They write the rules for these lobbyists, and the lobbyists can say, you know what? We're just out here exercising our constitutional right of free speech and petitioning our government. So it's really – lobbying is really impossible to stop, because what's to stop me from going to my guy on the county board and saying, hey, this ordinance is not a good idea. It's going to hurt this and this and this. And the guy says, oh, okay, I never looked at it that way. And so now they vote against it. Maybe I'm not benefiting from it materially at all. So how do you draw a line to say, well, you can't lobby, you can't go out and try and convince your congressman to do something that's going to make you money. But these lobbying groups, like the ethanol lobby, I think there's a 50-cent tax credit on every gallon of ethanol. And if we took that tax credit off, the ethanol industry would fall apart because they would lose that tax credit. So the ethanol industry has lobbying firms out there that they have that work with them to make sure that that ethanol tax credit is extended for a long time.
Who becomes a lobbyist? Now that I think about that.
Okay, lawyers become lobbyists.
Just everyday lawyers work their way up to becoming a lobbyist?
Well, you know,
you'd think it'd be people that were in Congress.
And there are former congressmen.
Because they would have those connections,
there are
those friendships.
There are former congressmen that go out and become lobbyists. There are people who are former chiefs of staff. There's all that kind of thing. And so those guys can go back and try and help work their magic. Now, term limits will help reduce lobbying in several ways. Number one, if you have... the lobbyist would have to buy a new person every 6 years.
What do you mean by buy a new person?
They would have to go out and give money to get somebody reelected. So, and now, when I use these names, I'm not saying that these people have done anything like this. But for instance, Mary Miller has this district that she is very, very, very comfortable in. So, if a lobbyist goes out and gives Mary Miller $100,000 campaign contribution or whatever amount they give to be able to go in and talk to her, she's not necessarily going to need it. So they know that if they give money to her, that they're buying influence with her, or they are getting influence with her. Every year they're going to give her this much money. She can take and disperse that money to other candidates. So that gives her more power. So makes her more powerful, and they're the ones that are providing that money to her. Therefore, she's the one that gets benefits from that, even though she's very safe in her own reelections. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and again, I'm not alleging anything when I use her name, because
sure,
there's Democrats that are the same way. Dianne Feinstein, you used her. Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi's never going to be beaten in a general election, and she's not going to be taken out in a primary. So she's the one that the lobbyists want, because she's going to be there for as long as she wants. So they go in and they pour money into her, makes her more powerful. She disperses it to candidates that need it. So, for instance, here again, Mary Miller was running against Rodney Davis. So if there's a very powerful Republican from another state, he comes in, he says, hey, Mary or Rodney, whichever one of you guys will do my bidding when you get there, I'll give you a bunch of money, and I'll get this guy to give you money, and we'll just get all this money and we'll bring it into you. Now they have influence over that person. So now that congressman exerts influence not only over his own vote, but the votes of others. Mm-hmm. So if you're a lobbyist, you want them. You want the guy, you want that guy that's very safe in his district. You want to pour money into him to make sure that he is going to exert his influence over these others to make sure that you get what you want.
Right. And then your credibility as a firm goes up and your track record goes
absolutely
up. People are willing to pay you more because you're more quality and getting,
yep,
you offer a higher success rate, so they, yep, go to you. It's,
and it just keeps working its way up and up and up. Now, the other thing that term limits will do is this. It will eliminate that person who's been there for so long. Because right now, excuse me, I'll grab a little swig of coffee here.
Oh, of course.
So right now, let's say I've been in Congress for 20 years, and I'm going to be here for another 10 or 15, and then I'm going to quit. And then I'm going to go become a lobbyist. And you're a brand new congressman, right? All, you know, just first day in. And I've been here for a long time, and I'm a powerful guy. And I come into your office. I said, Paul, man, I was following your campaign. Boy, you know, you did a great job. I am so thrilled to have you here. You know, I want you to have lunch with me. I want to introduce you to all these people. So I take you under my wing. So for the next 15 years, I am your mentor. And I work with you, and I try and get you bumped up into better committees. I take you on fact-finding missions with me. I do all this stuff. I make sure that you are my protege and you're happy as can be. So 15 years from now, I retire and I go become a lobbyist. Well, man, I got a key to your front door. Mm. I was your guy. I'm the guy that you looked up to. So now I still will be able to have a bunch of influence over you because of our relationship in the past. So now for the rest of my life, if I mentored you and, you know, 20 other guys, I got 20 votes in Congress that I can count on. I can absolutely count on because you'll do what I want you to because I'm your mentor.
Right.
So if we had term limits, so let's say I'm a 4-year congressman and they're limited to 6 years. I'm 4 years and you come in and I go, hey, Paul, you know, come on in. Let me introduce you around. I do all this. And so now I'm your mentor for 2 years and then I get termed out and I go become a lobbyist. For the next 4 years, I've got influence over you. But after that 4 years, when I go back to Congress, I don't know anybody. I didn't mentor anybody. There's nobody there that I served with. There's nobody there that remembers me. It was kind of like Scott Tillman, who helped me write the book. Scott Tillman's the I'm drawing a blank. Scott,
something that the U.S. term limits.
Yes, he's with Term Limits. And
which is an organization.
That promotes term limits, yes. And they helped write the book. So when you said you really liked the book, I would love to take credit for all the writing. There have been times when I've read through parts of the book and I went, man, that's brilliant. I wish I'd written that because somebody else had put it in the book. So I can't take credit for that book. I had a tremendous amount of help. But Scott Tillman said, if we have term limits, then when the congressperson becomes a lobbyist, and then they come back to Congress to try and exert influence, they will not be able to influence that. They will not be able to exert that influence for that long. They will be like the high school quarterback who his senior year, he is the star basketball player, star quarterback. He's the star athlete. He's the big man on campus. And the next year he comes back for homecoming and all the kids that are there remember him and they think he's just cool as can be and he's wearing his letter jacket and, you know, and he's still it, you know. And then the next year he comes back and, you know, there's still some people there that remember him and he's still wearing his letter jacket. 8 years later he comes back. Nobody knows who he is. He's just this creepy old dude wearing a letter jacket. And that's kind of what they would be in Congress is I wouldn't be able to influence you for 20 years because you wouldn't be there for 20 years.
Right.
Pretty soon I'm just going to be the creepy old guy hanging around the halls of Congress that nobody knows who I am.
Right.
And
right.
That's one of the things that term limits will do. And that's one of the reasons lobbyists and bureaucrats hate the idea of term limits. Because if they had term limits, they would lose a tremendous amount of power.
Right. and turkeys would not vote for
turkeys
Thanksgiving.
Turkeys would not vote for Thanksgiving, and chickens will never vote for Colonel Sanders.
Right, right. Well, Scott Murphy, hey, we'll have to do this again sometime because
I would love to.
We're running out of time here. I want to wrap up with just one final question.
Sure.
You have all these excellent points, incredible analogies and metaphors that suggest that we need to ratify term limits. Two questions. Why hasn't it been done, and how will we make it happen?
Great questions. Why hasn't it been done? Because those who write the rules win, and those who write the rules do not want term limits. And so Congress will do everything that they can to keep us from getting term limits. So that's why it hasn't happened.
How will we make it
happen? How will we make it happen? By getting the word out that we can do an Article 5. I wrote the book as a playbook to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And there are some politicians that are up and coming that are talking about using my book in their campaigns. They're talking about using it as a fundraiser. So you give $100, they're going to send you a free book. Trying to get the book out, trying to get everybody on one page, because it's with unity, that's where we can really, really make something happen. We have to be united. And the back few chapters of the book deal with that. It's got to be unity. We have to have everybody together. Republicans, Democrats, men, women, every race, everybody has to be on board with this. And then we have to force our people within the states to call for a constitutional convention and call for this to be done. One of the things that if the people in the states actually understood what was going on, then they would be all for term limits. The people in Springfield, so let me show you how this would work, kind of the way that any progression works. If you want to be a new baseball player, you start in Little League, you go to Little League, grade school, you go all the way up through and until you finally make it to the majors. Nobody just jumps right to the majors. So with this, you would start out with running for school board, and then you'd know there was going to be an opening on the county board because county board's being term limited. And the people on the county board would know that there are openings in the state legislature. And some of them might go on to be city councils in bigger cities and all that, but they would move up. And so politicians would naturally move up. We wouldn't have any inexperienced politicians in Washington, D.C., because they would have already been through the stages of school board, county board, city council, mayor, state representative, state senator, representative in Congress. And they would know that they could move up. Now, with Don Young being in Alaska, it being the representative in Alaska, he had to die before somebody else got a chance to run. He's been there for 50 years. So nobody ever got to run in 50 years. Now that he's gone, nobody ran against him, but now that he's gone, now there's a lot of people vying for his seat. We will have so many more choices if we get term limits. So many more choices. And our people, our politicians will have the opportunity to move up. Anybody who is in Alaska's Senate, in the state Senate, for the last 50 years has not been able to move up to Congress in Washington because Don Young has had a monopoly on that seat. Mm-hmm. So that's how we get it done. We call for a constitutional convention, we get people on board, and we vote one-issue politics. And this is a bad deal. I hate one-issue politics because it often screws up things that because you get somebody in who's only got one thing, a one-trick pony. But one-issue politics for term limits, you only vote for folks who say, I am for term limits. And then we make people be accountable. If you're not for term limits, we're not going to vote for you. We got 92% of the people. 92%. With 92% of the vote, we can do this. But we have to be united. And if you say, well, you got to vote for a Democrat because the Republican's not for term limits, okay, do that. Hold your nose and vote for the Democrat. Or say, I got to vote for a Republican because the Democrat's not for. Hold your nose and vote for the Republican. Do vote for those who are going to give you term limits. And once we get over that hurdle, we eliminate the professional politician. That's when we can take back Congress.
Understood. Incredibly well articulated. Scott Murphy, author of The Term Limit Revolution. Check this book out.
It's on Amazon.
It has lots of great reviews. You have over 11,000 followers on your Facebook page. this heck of a book. It's really been an honor talking to you today, and I hope we can do it again because I've learned so much, and it's really been amazing, and it's a shame that I have to end it here, but I got another guest coming in just a second. So.
Anytime you want me back, you give me a call. It has been a pleasure to be here, and I wish you a great deal of success with this endeavor.
My man. All right.
Thank you,
Scott
sir.
Murphy, it's been a pleasure. Thank
Indeed.
You very much, and thank you everyone for watching and listening to The Paul Garcia Show. God bless, and have a great week.